Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lots of news and economy still struggling and resignations all over this week. New York Governor Eliot Spitzer takes a spectacular fall amid eye-popping prostitution allegations.
I believe correctly that people, regardless of their position or power, take responsibility for their conduct. I can and will ask no less of myself.
Race card allegations fly as Geraldine Ferraro departs the Clinton campaign.
I personally think that this is the last time that the Obama campaign is going to be able to play this type of a race card, because I think that's what it is. If anybody was going to, they should apologize for me for calling you a racist.
And an outspoken Admiral William J. Fallon is out early from the top of U.S. Central Command. Here's Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
I have approved Admiral Fallon's request to retire with reluctance and regret.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. Joining me today from Washington is Ken Walsh. He's chief White House correspondent and senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. Ken, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be back.
Great to have you. Also joining us from Washington is Jackie Combs. She's chief political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Jackie, great to have you here.
It's good to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic, as opposed to Pacific Monthly. Hi, Jack. Good to have you.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ken. And hi, Jackie.
Let's go straight. So much to look at today. Just so much. But let's go straight to this Spitzer business. Is there a bottom line we can figure out here? Are there multiple bottom lines? Jackie Combs, what is to be said at the end of this week with his torrent of Spitzer revelations and then his resignation? What does it leave you thinking?
Well, it was quite a distraction from the presidential campaign, I'll say that, and it came at a good time for those of us who are covering the presidential campaign, because there's a relative lull here before the Pennsylvania primary at the end of April. I think the thing to be said is that people just can't underestimate what a shock this is to everyone. You know, a lot of times when there's a scandal like this, that's one of a personal nature, a sex scandal, people who've covered politics will say, well, that's no surprise. For instance, you know, a recent example, Larry Craig, that wasn't a huge surprise to people in Washington. Eliot Spitzer is a huge surprise. I haven't talked to anyone, and I certainly, speaking for myself, I never would have guessed this about him.
Ken Walsh, here we go with Eliot Spitzer, who was a crusader on Wall Street. He made a lot of enemies there. We heard stories of cheers in bars around Wall Street, even on the trading floor when this news came out. It leaves you wondering, first of all, for all his crusading, here we are in the middle of the subprime mess. It doesn't look as though Wall Street and the American financial system avoided corruption despite having somebody like Eliot Spitzer in there. I mean, he clearly made a mistake when it comes to his family and his career and as he said himself, his personal morals. But where does this leave our sort of aggressiveness, our teeth, our policing of the American financial system if a guy like Eliot Spitzer is gone?
Right. Well, of course, this was a tragic personal flaw here his very much aggressive focus on the financial system and to weeding out corruption and excess and so on. I think the thrust of his public career remains as something that people can judge up or down. This had nothing to do with that. This was a personal tragedy, and that's what partly makes it such an amazing story, in that the idea of how the mighty have fallen and hypocrisy, and because he had prosecuted these same types of prostitution rings in the past. But it's really the personal story that makes it so amazing. I mean, we're still getting all these numbers coming out about the economy. Now we had some inflation numbers now that look positive,
for
a little better. But still, there's just one bad report after another, and that remains. But I think the Spitzer, scandal stands alone as a case of you know, a personal flaw and a sort of a, almost a secret life, which I guess really it turns out to be that, and that's what makes it so compelling to so many people, because this man might not have been known around the country, but certainly the more people look at the story, they can connect with it, because it, as Jackie said, it came out of the blue, but also it just shows that you know, so many of our public figures, you know, who seem to be one thing, I think Americans will think, well, what are they really doing in private? And I think that goes to the credibility of people in public life, unfortunately.
Jack Beatty, personal corruption here. Elliot Spitzer himself made no qualms about that. You know, he said, I've always called for people to take responsibility. I've got to do it myself. But I'm looking here at an interesting column by Greg Palast. This was... and he's reminding, he says, while Elliot Spitzer was paying this escort $4,300 in a hotel room in Washington, just down the road, George Bush's new Federal Reserve Board Chairman Ben Bernanke was secretly handing over $200 billion in a tryst with mortgage bank industry speculators. Now, I don't know how secret that was. We heard about the $200 billion that they're going to lend this week to try and get credit flowing again, but Palast is saying, you know, there's a, up until Wednesday, he writes, there was only one single lonely politician who stood in the way of this creepy little assignation at the banker's bordello, and that was Elliot Spitzer. He's looking at all the lending that was done during the subprime sort of super corruption of the system and saying Elliot Spitzer was one of the few guys who was out there pointing fingers, ringing alarm bells, trying to do something about it.
Yes, and now he's gone. Of course, as governor, his that wasn't necessarily on his agenda. And yet, you know, it is a surprise, and people who know him better say, as Jackie did, a shock. And yet, now in hindsight, when we look at the way he pursued these enemies of right-doing on Wall Street and other places, when we look at the way he did it, you see his ruthlessness. You see a man driven almost to destroy other people, calling people who wrote a called a man who wrote a column criticizing him in the Wall Street Journal and said, I'm going to get you. This is the attorney general of a New York state saying that, that he went out of his way to sort of spill this aggression that was in him onto other people. And, you know, you don't have to be you don't have to go too far to see a continuity in that destructive impulse in his own life. I mean, he's now the spectacle of a man destroying himself is something that wouldn't have surprised St. Paul and or nor Sigmund Freud. This is sort of one of the part of the human condition, but on such a scale and on to go from so high to at least morally so low, it's just sobering. But I do think there is this, yes, he went after these malefactors of great wealth, to quote Teddy Roosevelt, but he did it in a way that that really called into question, it seems to me, his probity as a public servant.
Jackie Combs, how about it? You're with the Wall Street Journal. I'll let it go, but I still can't get it out of my mind. We're looking at an enormous national price tag that's coming due now on a bunch of lending that was done that was so crazy that we've now got, you know, major firms now, Carlyle bankrupt and the whole economy in trouble. I mean, Elliot Spitzer may not have had a sweet way of going about it, but haven't we just come through a period where there was a kind of endemic corruption in our financial system that we're all paying the piper for now?
Oh, there's no question. You know, and in terms of Elliot Spitzer, as Jack pointed out, as governor of New York, Elliot Spitzer was no longer undertaking some of those causes that he had as attorney general. But he truly did lead the ranks of state attorney generals all over the country in some of these causes. And now, I mean, we're going to be in for a long period of shaking out here. And, you know, the president's program that he's announcing today in an economic speech in New York City is more geared towards the future, and it would be somewhat typical of President Bush's approach. It would rely on the industry itself and some of the state regulators to sort of cooperate in policing some of these lax and in fact sometimes fraudulent lending practices, and so that we don't have this sort of credit crisis in the future, which, you know, affects the entire economy. I mean, everyone from homeowners to small businesses to corporations is having trouble getting credit and loans, and it can't help but freeze up the economy. So, you know, I would like to think, though, that there are other Elliot Spitzers out there but who could pursue, you know, these ends without having the, you know, incredibly huge personal flaws.
Maybe so, but he sure looked lonely out there for a while. Not many who was making as big a stink as he did before it all came down. Let's get a quick call before the break from Buffalo, New York. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. The reason I'm calling you is, and there was a great article in the New Republic on Wednesday. Scott Horton had written it, but I think the scandal that I think is behind the scandal was the investigation of Elliot Spitzer politically motivated. I mean, you're looking at really relatively small amounts of money that were involved, that were allegedly moved, and then he said that this could be a bribery investigation. You're talking about sums of $40,000, $80,000 over a few years.
Tom, our time is short before the break. Let me go straight to Ken Walsh with that. Ken, what about it? We do have sort of eyebrow-raising new levels of surveillance here. They were looking at where the money was going, wondered if it was political corruption. Do you see any political motivation? All this detail that spilled out immediately, the feds told everything about Kristen, the prostitute, the assignations. Does it look at all political to you, Ken?
Well, you're getting some chatter in Washington about exactly that. You know, where did this come from? Who pointed to Spitzer? Who was cooperating in the investigation? Was it fair to single him out like this? To me, this is something, a clear case. He's admitted it, and the senior political official in the state, committing a crime. I think that to me, it's not as important as who pointed the finger as it is the reality of the crime itself.
He's gone now. Ken Walsh, Jackie Combs, Jack Beatty, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at a week in the news. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Elliot Spitzer out in shame. Obama wins Mississippi. Geraldine Ferraro leaves the Clinton campaign. The economy still scary and more. Jackie Combs, chief political correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, is with us from Washington. Also, Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent and senior editor for U.S. News and World Report. Jack Beatty's here. Geraldine Ferraro talked with us a couple of weeks about where Obama stands in the campaign, race and sex, gender in this year's Democratic contest. Then it just exploded out of some comments she made to a newspaper in California. Earlier this week, she defended those comments on Good Morning America. Here she's trying to put her comments into context.
So I was asked after the speech, what is the reason that you see that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are at this level together? Could I have said because his experience is what puts him there? No. Could I say because his stand on issues have distinguished him? No.
Barack Obama responded to Ferraro's comments on his success on the campaign trail and his race. Here, Barack Obama breaks down what he sees as her flawed reasoning.
I think that if anybody was looking for the quickest path to the presidency, they would not say, I want to be an African-American man named Barack Obama. I don't think that's in the handbook for running for president.
Jackie Combs, what do you make of the Ferraro story this week? She was clearly really angry at where she got caught in this whole conversation, and now she's off the Clinton Finance Committee. What do you see here, Jackie?
Well, in a broader perspective, what I see is that she is the extreme example of what some women who are, and particularly of her generation, who are really eager to see a woman as president in their lifetime, and who will be very angry if Hillary Clinton isn't the nominee. And, we've talked a lot in recent weeks about how angry African Americans in the Democratic Party could be if they feel or come to believe that Barack Obama doesn't get the nomination and loses it in a way they consider unfair. But women, there's a lot of women out there who are angry too, and this has been whipped up somewhat by the Clinton campaign, who sees advantage in having sympathy card played among women. What, you know, they're complaining about her treatment, Hillary Clinton's treatment in the media, and by, you know, in particular by, you know, cable pundits like Chris Matthews. So there's that. And other than that, I mean, Hillary, I talked to some people who knew Geraldine Ferraro quite well, worked in the Mondale campaign, and there is a lot about this that's just particular to Geraldine Ferraro. They said at the time of her when she was vice president and she was in trouble for her husband's and her finances, that she was very stubborn about and outspoken when, you know, just a more diplomatic or political response would have been called for.
Here's what she said to the Torrance, California newspaper, and this is where she got the most explicit about it. If Obama was a white man, he would not be in this position. And if he was a woman of any color, he would not be in this position. He happens to be very lucky to be who he is in the country, is caught up in the concept. Ken Walsh, who's playing the race card here?
Well, this is, you know, for a while in this campaign, everybody was sort of was treading very carefully on this race issue, and it's as the campaign has gotten more closer and gone on longer, this sort of demon race issue, this notion of our terrible history of racial problems has come back up again as sort of the demon issue in the campaign. But I think that what's happened here is now it's we're in this very clear debate over, you know, race, sometimes unfair, sometimes fair. And in Ferraro's case, not only did she make the comments, Tom, you just referred to, but she kept coming back to it.
Yeah.
And then a little later she said, "I really think they're attacking me because I'm white." You got into that notion of victimization, and then she came back to it again and again on TV and in other interviews, and then she sort of gave up the role she had on the Finance Committee, of Hillary Clinton. But I think that a lot of African American leaders and citizens just felt that this was bordering on sort of an affirmative action issue, that she was saying, well, this guy got where he is not because of his talents or his experience, as she said in that quote you referred to, but because of his race. And so this strikes a lot of African-American leaders very wrong, and I'm not sure exactly if that's the way Ferraro meant it. It doesn't appear that she did, but this whole issue is becoming so radioactive now. And the other thing I wanted to mention real quick is that this is in the context of other comments about race that have been made in the Clinton campaign that a lot of people have talked about, going back to Bill Clinton dismissing Barack Obama during the South Carolina primary as sort of, well, he's another black candidate like Jesse Jackson. In other words, he's in a niche that we've seen before. He's not really a truly national candidate.
A niche that puts him down. Saying. It's been bubbling up for a while. Here's Ferraro when she spoke with us just a couple of weeks ago, saying that Obama had it easier in the race.
If you say something about Barack Obama, people accuse you of being racist. I mean, it becomes a mantra. So, you know, what's happened is I think they've been treated differently. I think both sexism and racism are wrong. But I honestly believe that if she were treated as fairly as he has been treated, that we would have a different race going on now.
Let's go to Pamela in North Bennington, Vermont. Pamela, what do you think?
Hi, Tom. What I think is, it was an interesting comment. Do I think that it was racist and insinuated racism? Absolutely. And because of how she said, if Obama was a white man, then he would not be where he is. But she also, when she had to defend her statement, degraded herself as a woman. And I take double offense to that, because guess what? I fit both of those categories. I'm not white, and I am a woman. She went on to say, well, if my name had been Gerald Ferraro, I would not have been chosen to run for the vice presidency. So thus, not only was she saying and insinuating that race plays a role in this, but also she's insinuating sexism. And that was what really infuriated me with her. And the more she went on with it, as your guest pointed out, the bigger she just dug a hole for herself to jump into.
Pamela, thanks very much. Jack Beatty, what do you see here?
Well, you know, James Carville has said that Pennsylvania is Philadelphia on the east and Pittsburgh on the west and Alabama in the middle. And this was aimed at the Alabama. You look at polls, the part of civil rights that white people are not on board with clearly is affirmative action. There's a dissensus there, a marked difference between what the races think about that. And this is, she just keeps, as Ken said, she was just, you know, banging away at the idea that somehow this man was was a quota appointment to the presidential nominating field, when, in fact, it's clear that his talents, his judgment of the issues, his sense of where the country was, his crying out for change when people wanted change, that all of these things clearly have, and his brilliance have made him an outstanding candidate. And if anything, his race is, you know, has probably held him back. But you know, Hillary Clinton's campaign and her supporters have to face up to this. This thing is getting ugly on her side. There was the Steve Croft interview on 60 Minutes just a week ago, where now some people think she's being harshly criticized there, but she did make the, when asked, you know, is Senator Obama a Muslim? And she said, there's nothing to base that on, as far as I know. Now, that came at the end of a series of, maybe that was just a filler in the, you know, to fill up the time, but that, as far as I know, I mean, yeah. that's shameless. And you know, what could she win that would make this means, that would justify the kind of means she's doing? As it is now, she's left with just this. She's got to destroy this guy in order to win. And then she's got to get the superdelegates to essentially overrule, as it looks like, the person who has the most pledged delegates. In other words, she's got to resort to sort of anti-democratic means to win. Is that really something to be proud about?
Yeah, democracy gets pretty tricky here. Jackie, Ken, I want to hear from you, but let's go first to Mike in Beaufort, South Carolina. Mike, what do you see here?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and sure. I love the show.
Thanks.
White male from South Carolina. My wife and I both supported Barack Obama in the South Carolina primary here, so he got more than just blacks vote in South Carolina, which everybody knew. But I don't think Geraldine Ferraro was racist in her comments. They may have not have been accurate or the best thing to say. But what scares me the most is they're going to destroy the Democrats' chance of taking back the White House. And I think America has got an opportunity here to show the rest of the world that we are as progressive as we say we are. You know, we can be a world leader once again. And part of that would be showing that we have no problems, whether it be a black man or a woman, because I think those are the best candidates by far to lead this country for the next 4 years. We've got a chance to make a statement, but if all this infighting keeps on, we're going to fall on our face, and John McCain will be the next president, and we'll be right where we are 4 years from now, wondering what the heck has happened to our economy and our nation.
Mike, thank you for your call. Jackie, let me come to you, because I know you've been doing some polling on exactly this front at the Wall Street Journal. What have you found, Jackie?
Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, it's only been 3 months ago that in our December polls for the Wall Street Journal and NBC News, Hillary Clinton was still getting the bulk of the black voters' support. It was only after she lost Iowa, the Iowa caucuses on January 3rd, that there seemed to be this feeling. It was palpable. And you talked to voters that black voters who had been sort of holding back thought, white people really might vote for this man, Barack Obama, and so it made it okay for some of them. They didn't want to be on a losing cause. They actually liked the Clintons, as we've all written about and talked about. But then you not only had the vote in mostly white Iowa showing blacks that maybe this man can do it, you then had in the course of January the comments that were made among Clinton supporters, and then mostly Bill Clinton in the South, campaigning later that month in the South Carolina primary, that angered blacks. And so you've ever since the first votes have been cast, you know, right up until those first votes, Hillary Clinton was still in our polls getting most of the black vote among black Democrats. Once the votes were cast, ever since, she's lost it to the point where it's now 10-1 against her.
Bring us up to date. Your headline this week is McCain, GOP, may have cause for hope. And it's right along the lines that our caller Mike in South Carolina is describing.
Right. Well, at bottom, what you have is a situation where all the polling measures are bad for Republicans and getting worse. And then if you ask voters in a generic basis, do you want a Democrat to win the White House or a Republican, the spread is now favors Democrats by double digits, 13 points, 50% to 37%. But when you put names to that choice, and it's John McCain versus Hillary Clinton or John McCain versus Barack Obama, it's a statistical tie. Barack Obama leads John McCain by 3 percentage points, but our margin of error was 3.1 percentage points. Hillary Clinton leads by 2 points, which is within the margin of error. So you have a dead heat, and so what you have is proof that when people vote, they would prefer the party, the Democratic Party, a majority would, but people vote for a person, especially for the presidency. And in that regard, John McCain brings some strengths to the race. And meanwhile, either of the Democratic candidates bring strengths as well as weaknesses that give voters pause.
Could get trickier before it gets easier. Let's take a call from Renee in Boston. Renee, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay.
My comment would just be that I believe Barack Obama is trying to run a positive campaign, and I believe that the Democrats need to run a positive campaign. I also believe that Senator Clinton wants to win at any cost, but that she really just needs to focus on presenting herself and her issues and why she should be, you know, the nominee, instead of trying to say, vote for me, not for him, because if they both just state their own case, their own positive case, and stay away from tearing each other down, then no matter who wins the nomination, the Democratic Party can stay intact. But if Hillary Clinton continues to use any tactic, underhanded or overhanded, you know, to bring down Barack Obama, then I think we're destroying our chances for November.
But, of course, it's Renee, it's Geraldine Ferraro who this week says it's the Obama camp playing the race card, that what she said was innocent, straightforward, and that brings us right to this superdelegate business and the issue of Michigan and Florida and whether there should be a redo on the primaries there. On Thursday morning this week, we heard Hillary Clinton, who's been pushing to count those primary votes, even though the Democratic National Committee had said no to their early date for primaries. Here she talked to NPR's Steve Inskeep about why the primary results should be counted, even though Senator Obama's name wasn't on the ballot.
It wasn't that he didn't participate at all. In fact, there was a real effort to get people to vote uncommitted, and I still won 55% of the vote.
You say that that is a fair result, mm-hmm. even without Barack Obama's name on the ballot?
Well, that was his choice, Steve.
It was his choice, Steve. His name not on the ballot in Michigan. This morning on NPR's Morning Edition, Barack Obama objected to that suggestion that those results were fair and should be counted.
We agreed not to participate in this process. Not just me, but Senator Clinton did as well. If you asked my six-year-old, should that election count, she would probably be able to figure out that that's not fair.
Ken Walsh, where do you see Michigan and Florida headed in the Democratic hullabaloo here?
Well, another point in this is that at the same time that Barack Obama was saying they were deciding not to participate in Michigan, Hillary Clinton was saying, well, this is not going to count for anything. She was saying very clearly, you know, these delegates are not going to count in this
months
situation.
Ago when all that
months
first
ago.
Was laid out.
Mm-hmm. Months ago. So this mm-hmm. is now a different iteration sort of her stand on all this because, of course, she won in Michigan and she's looking for every advantage to get the delegates. But we have two real major shoes to drop here in determining this nomination. And one thing to sort of circle back on what we were saying before, this race is becoming not polarized not only on the race and gender issues, but if you look at the Clinton and Obama supporters, they're increasingly saying they would not be happy with the other candidate as their nominee. So the Democrats are heading into some very dangerous territory here in dividing themselves. But I think we've got the now the superdelegates, these so-called about 800 elected officials and party activists and leaders who are don't have to make their choice for president, the nominee, on the basis of caucuses or primaries. They can use whatever standard they want to. So that's one area where there's still some movement, and that's one area that could be decisive. The other is Michigan and Florida, and these are the two states that held primaries that were too early. So the Democratic National Committee penalized them by disqualifying all their delegates. So Florida has now been going through this whole argument, and we've seen the coverage this week of the state party trying to come up with a mail-in option, which has many, many legal and technical problems, and all of the
members of Congress, members of the House from Florida, of both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton supporters, oppose this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Elliot Spitzer out. Obama wins in Mississippi. Ferraro leaves the Clinton campaign. The economy still with all kinds of trouble and efforts to lift it off a little bit of a scary course here. Ken Walsh is with us from U.S. News and World Report. Jackie Combs, chief political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, is here. And Jack Beatty, the media this week and late night comedy in particular could not get enough of Elliot Spitzer. Here's Stephen Colbert.
It was such a big story that the media followed the governor's SUV through traffic for over 20 minutes in the hope that he would stop and pick up a prostitute. You do not want to see what he's got in his mud flaps.
Whoa, and George Bush gets bootleg tape for YouTube at Washington's annual power dinner of the Gridiron Club. Here's the president goofing at some length to the tune of Green, Green Grass of Home.
I spend my days clearing brush. I clear my head of all the fuss.
Like that big fuss you made over Harriet and Brownie. Down the lane I look and here comes Scooter, finally free of the prosecutor.
Can't get enough? Here's some more from the president, our American idol.
And then I wake and look around me at the oval walls that surround me. And I realize I was only dreaming. For there's Condi and Dick, my old compadre, talking to me about some oil-rich Saudi. But soon I'll touch the brown, brown grass of home.
President Bush at the Gridiron Club dinner this week. Oh, my goodness. A little cell phone can capture just about anything these days. Ken Walsh, you cover the White House. What do we make of the gridiron yucks there and the president? Is he longing to get out of the Oval Office?
Well, I'm sure he can thank his lucky stars for the writers who come up with these things. But, you know, that audience, and in fact, all of these media dinner audiences in Washington, you know, I've been participating in the White House Correspondents' Dinner for many years. It's actually, in the end, a pretty easy audience for a president if he has some decent material to deal with and sort of tries to be a little self-deprecating, which is what President Bush did. There's a long history of this sort of thing. And, you know, it's interesting that some version of this stuff always gets bootlegged out of the room, even though it's supposed to be, you know, private and off the record. And but, you know, to me, this is pretty much shows that I think the media just we eat this stuff up if a president tries to sort of cater to us and make a little fun of himself. So it's you know, I don't think the bar is very high here for a president at these dinners.
Jack Beatty, though, there's always that little bit of shock of nose against the glass of the public looking in on the sort of palsy media and power elite in Washington.
Yes, indeed. And what that tells us about the sort of seamless flow between media and power. And, you know, of course, while the president was yucking it up, 12 Americans were killed in 2 days by suicide bombers in Iraq. And this comes as the Pew Center has released a poll that found that today just 28% of Americans can come up with the number of Americans killed there, or even approximately. As of Monday, it was 3974. In August, 54% could estimate it correctly. And this is also reflected in partly caused by the contraction of the news hole devoted to Iraq news. 15% last year on average, just 3% of the news hole in February. The war has slipped from people's minds. And, you know, I was just reading this week a famous letter, Siegfried Sassoon, the war poet hero, wrote to the London Times. He wrote a letter called Finished with the War, a Soldier's Declaration, for which he was put into a psychiatric institution.
It's quite a different war from Iraq.
Indeed, indeed. And he writes, I have seen and endured the suffering of the troops, and I can no longer be a party to prolong these sufferings for ends which I believe to be evil and unjust. Also, I believe that I may help to destroy the callous complacence with which the majority of those at home regard the continuance of agonies which they do not share and which they have not sufficient imagination to realize.
Mm. Sassoon on a different war. Ken Walsh?
Yeah, I just wanted to add another thing. That that Pew poll, I think, is a very telling point on the casualty side. But what a lot of Democrats are saying is that there's a pivot point here that maybe Americans aren't resonating with the casualties because as in a volunteer army, it's not affecting the country as the Vietnam War did with the draft, where many more families were affected. But the cost of the war is another pivot point. And this is as the economy worsens, as the economy becomes more of an issue, that there's a sense in the Democratic Party from their internal polling that this notion of we're spending all this money, it perhaps is contributing to the economic problems we have, this trillion-dollar war, where will it all end, that they see some resonance in that as an issue as opposed to the casualties per se.
Ken, though, you've got a column coming out this weekend, I think, which looks at how the Republican National Committee is tracking public opinion, though, and they too see possibilities in this coming year in some of what you say they're finding. Fill us in.
Yeah, well, there's some new polling from internal Republican polling that the White House is chattering about now, that if you dissect Bush's policies, there's a number of his policies that are quite popular with the American public. If you, ask the
question.
On the
war, on the economy, on what?
Well, apparently 52%, according to these polls, or this particular poll, now approve of the president's surge into Iraq. Now, you see that in other polls, too. I believe the poll in the Journal also reflects something close to this, but that there's support for the president's efforts to help homeowners as far as that goes. The economic stimulus package seems to be popular. This monitoring of foreign communications of suspected terrorists and so on, which is causing such a fuss. Mm-hmm. But what it adds up to is they've tried so many other things to lift the president's job approval ratings. Now their argument is focus on the policies, not the person. Now, I mean, I think it reflects how difficult it is to lift the president's job approval ratings, because this is sort of their last stab at as sort of a legacy revival. And a lot of people are sort of skeptical that this would work. But if you do dissect his policies, there are some policies that are quite popular, although he remains in job approval very low, and most Americans, 7 or 7.5 out of 10, people feel the country's heading in the wrong direction. So, but I think it's they're still trying to sort of lift his approval, but it's going to be a tough slog.
Jackie, talk to us for a moment about how the economy is going to intersect with all this. Maybe a little bit better news on inflation today, but wow, we have just seen one bad indicator after another, big companies in big trouble, the market up dramatically on the news of intervention this week, and then down again, Asian markets way down. Is there any sign or hope of pulling off of what can some days feel like kind of a big nosedive out there? How do you see that hitting the politics of the balance of this year, Jackie?
Well, if you went back to November 2006 after the midterms for the congressional elections, which was an election that mostly turned on people's increasing opposition to the war, a lot of people would have guessed that the 2008 presidential race was also going to be about the war, on the assumption, which was a good one at the time, that it would still be going on. Instead, what you saw is late last year, around September, the economy moved to the forefront, and it remains, and our poll showed again this week, the number one issue for the country, and by a large amount. And it's not just the economy in general, a vague feeling of uncertainty and worry. It's actually hitting people now. So the truism in politics that, a lot of people vote their pocketbooks is going to take place. There is virtually no one who thinks the economy will improve enough by November. And, we saw back in 1992, when President Bush's father lost for re-election, the Republicans will say in retrospect that the economy was actually coming out of a recession and improving before he was defeated. But the public didn't, the voters didn't feel that. And so, you know, the credit for the economy recovering went to what there was of it to go to a president went to President Bill Clinton. So I think the economy will remain the big issue. And it's not that the war has totally gone away. I just want to say that because a lot of people tell me, including our pollsters, Republican and Democratic pollsters that we have, will tell you that people have just sort of factored in the war. And I think it was, I don't know if it was Ken or Jack made the point about the cost of the war. That is a big, you know, that's become, the war has become intertwined with the economy as an issue because people are saying if we weren't spending $1 trillion in Iraq, we could be addressing these other issues. And our poll, you know, just one more thing on the war is that the surge indeed, there is an agreement that it has worked on a military level, but
public opinion feels that way, you're saying.
Right, yeah. Right. But the war itself remains unpopular by an overwhelming majority. The overwhelming majority still believes that we were wrong to go in and invade Iraq in the first place. And so, you know, the war itself remains unpopular. There, you just have this unease. The voters are unclear as to just how soon to get out. They don't want, you know, having, as Colin Powell once said, you know, if you break it, you own it, as he warned the president. Well, we broke it. Arguably, so the public thinks we can't leave without it being stable. That said, our poll showed yet again that people want to start withdrawing troops next year when the new president takes office.
And maybe Admiral Fallon wanted some of that too, but of course he's gone. Let's get a call from George in Rutland, Vermont. George, you're on the air.
Hi, folks. How are you?
Pretty good. What do you see, George?
Well, what I see is I'm a 62-year-old Vietnam veteran. And I see that most people don't care about your polls. They care about what's happening every day to them. I ask my neighbors on either side of me where I live and on my own home, and they also, how are you affected by the polls and the politicians? And you know what they tell me? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. People have given up on mattering about who's going to be elected. This goes all the way back to our beginning as a country. This country was based upon rich people getting richer and richer. I'm not a socialist. I am absolutely infirmed in owning a business and working hard and having a life for your family. But if you're expecting some politician to help you, you better get that out of your head because it's never going to happen.
George, sounds like you're bailing out on it there. Thanks for your call. Let's get another here from Luray, Virginia, and Irina. Irene, you're on the air.
Yes, Irina. That's exactly, my comment is exactly related to what this gentleman was just saying. People don't believe things anymore. My comment is about Hillary Clinton's tactics. I cannot believe that the methods that are being used are straight out of Karl Rove's playbook, and that the media, for the most part, is picking up on this. I mean, not picking up on this a whole lot. She decided that if she just repeats lies over and over again, they eventually will stick. Many people don't pay as much attention as I do. I follow everything. And it's just infuriating that it's talked in the same breath about the fact that she did not live up to the agreement that she signed. And there's some inconsistencies, minor inconsistencies in some speeches, for example, in Barack Obama made in the past. It is outright lie.
Irina, we hear it. You're not on board with the Clinton attack yet. It's a tough fight in there, and she's fighting hard. Let's get one more here from Iowa City, Iowa. Donita, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you know?
Well, I am a white woman over 50 from a white state who is feels that Hillary Clinton's campaign has totally proved Barack Obama's point, that she represents politics of the past, she represents dirty, divisive politics, and that his voice continues to give us hope that there can be a better tomorrow.
Okay, we got it. And yet she won in Ohio and Texas, so somebody feels the other way. Ken Walsh, we're getting a rash of down-on-Hillary callers here. How do you read it?
Well, I mean, I disagree with the one caller who says, you know, people are giving up on who might make a difference here. I think, you know, the other callers show that there is still a lot of sense that it does make a difference who the president is. And now maybe by the end of this process, people will become very cynical again, which we touched on earlier. Mm. But I think that that at this point, I think there's a tremendous interest in this campaign, and there are differences not only among Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, but there will be differences between either of those and John McCain, quite substantive differences in policy. And I think that so it will matter, you know, the individual who's elected. And I think Americans understand that. I think that's partly why you're seeing this tremendous interest in giving money to the candidates, particularly the Democratic candidates, and these huge turnouts that have been happening, again, particularly for the Democratic side, which is the side that's pushing the change. Mm. And I think that notion of a change election still seems to be where we're headed.
Jackie Combs, we've got this long stretch now between the dust-ups of this week and Pennsylvania, the next big vote. What do you expect we're going to see in that period? Weeks and weeks where there's no vote, just lots of time for maneuver, punch and counterpunch. What are you expecting, Jackie?
Well, what we're seeing is behind the scenes a silent primary for the so-called superdelegates votes. And of the 795 delegates, which is about 20% of the total Democratic convention delegates, of that 795, less than a majority are still uncommitted. That said, the others who are committed can switch from between Obama and Clinton, and in fact, several have switched from Clinton to Obama. So what you're seeing is, aside from the public campaigning in Pennsylvania, is the behind-the-scenes courting, continued courting of the uncommitted superdelegates.
Jack Beatty, how do you see that coming down during these weeks? All quiet back in the smoke-filled rooms, or is it going to be more theater out front, more drama out front while that arm wrestling goes on?
I expect a combination, and the arguments that Hillary is using with these superdelegates, maybe they're starting to tell. There had been a drift toward Obama among them that seems to have stopped. Hillary has actually picked up a couple in recent days, so that front has to be watched as well.
Many fronts, from Iraq to right here at home, and on that economy, we'll keep watching. Ken Walsh with U.S. News and World Report, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Jackie Combs at the Wall Street Journal, chief political correspondent there. Jackie, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
Jack Beatty, have a good weekend, my friend.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.